This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawira Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann in Sawyers Bay, Dunedin, and I am joined from Whakatane by Mawira Karatai. Kia ora, Mawira.
Kia ora, Sam. How's it going?
It's going very well indeed. What exciting things are you working on this week?
Making bread. And there's somebody going to be selling my sourdough, which that was amazing. So, yeah, I've got to make some bread. And our mountain biking season is well underway now in the Eastern Rail Plenty. So lots of mountain biking activities and kids to put plasters on and feed sausages too.
And who are we introducing today?
It is my great pleasure to introduce Cameron Metherill as part of our Coming Up for Air series of University of Otago students in the Sustainable Business Program. Welcome, Cameron. Thank you for joining us.
No worries. Happy to be here.
Kia ora, Cameron. Where did you grow up, Cameron?
I grew up in Christchurch back in the day. I guess I spent my first 18 or so years there, and then moved to Wanaka briefly, and then through to Dunedin for my undergrad degree. Since then I've sort of bounced between Wanaka, Queenstown, and now I'm back through to Dunedin. So yeah, mostly in the south, but I'd say I'm still a Canterburyan at heart.
I'm not sure. I told somebody we forgave them from being from Christchurch, from Hamilton yesterday. I'm not sure if we could forgive a Cantabrian, but never mind. What did you want to be when you grew up?
Oh, great question. I think kind of depends how far back we look, really, but probably in the last 10 years, I think I didn't want to work. I just wanted to go have fun and do things like biking, like Mawira said. So I'm not too sure on that answer, to be honest.
But somehow you stumbled your way into an undergrad?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think I started out doing law in my undergrad, probably from watching the show Suits. Pretty glamorized, but quickly realized that law isn't quite what it's cut out to be on TV. I was quite interested in economics, which was the main kind of side of my undergrad, and then did marketing as well. I guess living in places such as Wanaka and Queenstown, you're a bit more inclined to get the lifestyle going as opposed to the career, I'd say.
So if our unsustainability problem is one of a growth mindset, growth and buying more stuff, we can blame you on both counts.
My bike's secondhand, if that matters. I think, it's a good... you got to use what you got, really. Things like skiing, biking, in some ways, aren't the most sustainable sports, despite the community being quite an environmental bunch, which I guess, kind of interesting conflict there.
So what led you down a route that's currently, I was going to say ended up, but currently in a place of doing sustainable business?
Yeah, good question. I just think it's generally a really important part of the next 30, next 100 years for the world, really, that we need to become more sustainable. And it's, yeah, an interesting space because, like, a lot's changing. So I think that's really interesting. And, yeah, like, as I said, like, I really enjoy the outdoors and stuff. So it's important that we take care of it. And, yeah.
Was there a moment where you realized that you could have that environmental concern not just be for your sport and for fun, but actually for a thing to do for work?
Hard to put an exact moment on it, I'd say. I could say in first semester, I was actually, when I first came back to uni, I was doing accounting, and we had one lecture across all four of my papers, a singular lecture on sustainability and sustainable reporting. And I thought that was just crazy that, you know, like, seems sort of like they've been teaching the same curriculum for years and years and years, and they've only thought to add one lecture in on sustainability. And I found that, I mean, I found the lecture interesting, but yeah, more than anything, it struck me that, you know, why isn't this a priority or a focus? You know, half this other accounting can be done by a computer these days, so why don't we focus on what's new? So yeah, that kind of inspired me to switch my postgrad degree across to, sustainable business.
Good call. Let's take your music choice. Who have we got? Natalie Rise and Kabuka Pyramid. This World. Why this one?
I was saying to Maria before, I was watching a bike movie, and it was a soundtrack to a cool segment with Robin Gooms and Casey Brown, a couple of free ride athletes. And yeah, it's just a bit of a banger. Listened to it in the movie and then looked it up, and yeah, been enjoying it since.
Well, in comes the music, I think. Kabaka to the pyramid alongside Natalie Rise once again, pandem. Oh. And we say, whoa. Say, whoa. And we say, whoa. One question me have for them. What's going on in this world? It's like something is wrong in this world. From the moment you're born, yeah, you gotta be strong if you wanna live long in this world. So we're moving on. If you want to be free, you're not stuck in a colony. Rebel with a cause, ready for defend my family. My land, my tradition and my culture automatically. Rastafari teach you unity and solidarity. Love for everyone embedded in my personality. Even though they want us to be just like a cavity, we still have come together no matter we nationality.
Yeah, despite their economy and their verbal monotony, we're still seeking their sovereignty while resisting their fuckery. Stick with our liberty, our real responsibility to create possibilities that reclaim our autonomy. Looking across at the seas, citizens under the breeze, left to be wounded by war, refugees, victims of greed. All in the talk in the world never resulted in peace. Governments watching a blood by the community.
What's going on in this world? It's like something is wrong in this world. From the moment you're born, yeah, you gotta be strong if you wanna live long in this world. And the smartphones they're using, they're watching us, and the music we're popular. Them infuse it with Dracula, Vanacula, and if you're not, them stop you like a mafia. Yeah. What's going on in this world? It's like something is wrong in this world. From the moment you're born, yeah, you gotta be strong if you wanna live long in this world.
from it, reaching out to every boy and every girl. Yeah.
Bubble Sprite of the Forest of Orokinui, Dunedin's favourite goddess, Tahu Mackenzie.
Kia ora koutou, ngā mihi aroha nui kia koutou, ko tāhua hau. I hope you're all having the best day, beautiful superstars in your beloved universes. And I really hope, wherever you are and whatever's happening around you, this journey that we're all on together is proving to be very rewarding, very sustaining, and illuminating for you more and more each day, who you are. A triumph of nature's art, perfect, unique, and here with crucial gifts to share. Now I know that for us all, the last several years, and indeed our current times, are filled with a myriad of challenges and puzzles and unexpected situations of which we must adapt to and allow to unfold whilst protecting ourselves and boundarying ourselves as only we can. And of course we find ourselves in the midst of change and turmoil that comes with change, and finding new ways of doing, being, seeing, feeling to navigate this change. We find ourselves at a crossroads in our experience of the human world. And for myself, whenever I find that the human world is limiting, is constrictive, is too narrow in its perception of our living reality, I always return to our first home, our true home, our infinite home. The living world. And the natural world, the living world, gives to me such a pure balm, a balm to my soul, and its beauty, the peace that I feel in connecting with the living world, everything that lives. I am so grateful to be related to, genetically, and one with, spiritually. I'm speaking to you now and I'm driving along to my first home, the Otago Peninsula, where I lived as a young girl, and I am staying again with my beautiful whānau, having navigated the separation in my own life. And I will return to my Wimansion next year, move in my beautiful identical twins, Pearl and Paulina, and that will be lovely. And in the meantime, I'm so grateful to be able to put my feet in the sea every day, and for the water to be so beautiful and clear and clean, and for there to be 11-armed stars and yellow-eyed mullet and Nick Tiffany, the beautiful krill that lights up with blue light, and cat's eye snails and wheel shells and turret shells, all these beautiful, beautiful life forms are there to greet my feet each day. And of course the water itself, which is now billions of years old, coming to meet me. All these things fill me with gratitude and joy and release any stress that I might have been holding on to throughout the day. So I really hope for you that you're finding strategies in your own day to reconnect with whatever aspect of your internal landscape brings you peace, brings you tranquility, brings you a sense of oneness and release, and how that aspect of your internal landscape is being projected and connected with externally. I know for us as a species that we have this ongoing communication that takes place between our inner and our outer landscapes. And it's fascinating to me how we traverse this potential that we all have for transmutation, and that we can take those aspects of our outer world which are difficult and we can bring them within, and we can reassemble them, we can reframe them, we can heal them, and we can release them back into the outer world. And this is a beautiful capacity that we all have. And as I speak to you, I'm driving past the beautiful ocean. I'm driving past the beautiful lush native bush, and the sun is shining. There is some blue sky, but it's mainly a very calm white and grey skyscape. And I feel very grateful to be here with you. So a huge thank you to Sam and the whole Blowing Bubbles team for having me, and I'll speak with you again soon. Thanks so much. Ka kite.
Cameron, we're going to listen to your podcast shortly. What would you like us to know about the person you interviewed and why you chose them?
Yeah, great question. So, yeah, I guess this one being a bit of a funny one, given that Oliver is Sam's son. So I'm sure you know, and I know that you know him quite well as well, Marera. So you guys probably know him, yeah, like I said, better than me.
We don't know him on the radio. We've been asking him for years. Well done.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I guess like when I was looking for someone to interview, I had a few things in mind. Like, I think primarily I kind of wanted someone who was, I'm going to put little speech marks here, but young, relatively. As someone who's, you know, starting out in my sustainability education and career, it's cool to find out like what's motivating these young people and, you know, why should I be motivated or what can I do to, yeah, get my foot in the door in a career. So, yeah, I probably actually talked more to Oliver about, you know, the why than the what. Of course, the podcast had to be trimmed down a bit, so you might not hear too much of that. I knew that Oliver sort of had his hands on a lot of things. He's involved in a few different areas of sustainability as well, so I thought that was really interesting. I'd say that's pretty much why I chose him. And I guess as well, like, being someone who's lived in Wanaka, my mum lives in Wanaka, like that area of the country is special to me as well. So the work he's doing there is, yeah, quite close to home for me too.
Welcome to the CCP, Cam's Climate Podcast. Today, we dive into the heart of one of Otago's most cherished treasures, our lakes and rivers. From the joy of recreation to the deep spiritual and cultural significance for iwi, our waterways are more than just beautiful landscapes. They're the lifeblood of our environment and communities. Our lakes and rivers are all-encompassing. Join us, myself, Cameron, and my guest today, Oliver Eden Mann, as we explore the growing threats to our precious ecosystems, from urban sprawl to climate change, and learn how local collectives are stepping up to make a difference. With collaboration, passion, and community action, there is hope for a sustainable future. Let's jump into it. For a little background on my guest today, Oliver Eden Mann, Ollie has worked with the likes of Y Wanaka, Water Action Initiative Wanaka, and ORC, the Otago Regional Council. I'd describe Ollie as being a young leader in the environmental initiative space, and he works in the Upper Clutha District, which is an area that I'm really close to, with whānau there, and spending a lot of time there in my childhood. Ollie is super knowledgeable and speaks so well about his craft. Ollie and I talked for well over an hour on topics ranging from his love of cheese to rural versus urban dynamics, theories of behaviour change, as well as why he loves sticking it to boomers, why top-down approaches are sometimes necessary, and how we can take ownership of our own actions. With time of the essence, I've kept the best bits from our conversation and focused today's episode around our discussion, power of cooperatives, sharing knowledge, and how Ollie has empowered small groups to make a difference. After the episode, if you're interested to hear more about the work that Ollie has done, highly recommend checking out the Why Wanaka website or the Young Environmental Collective's Instagram. To jump right into the conversation I had with Ollie, I'm going to read out an excerpt from the Why Wanaka website.
Especially during the warmer months of the year, there are so many ways to enjoy our lakes and rivers. What would happen if they were too polluted to be safe? Looking at what seems like pristine waters, it may be hard to imagine, but many of our rivers and lakes in our beautiful country are in this position right now. The threats to our freshwater are real, and they are growing. Whether from increased recreation, urban and rural development, the spread of pest flora and fauna, or the impacts of climate change, every day our waterways and their delicate ecosystems are under more pressure. So, Ollie, how real are these threats? And if you have specific examples from Wanaka as well, that would be great.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think those threats are incredibly real and very diverse in the sense that it's everything we do, especially in the urban environment, has an impact on for example, Lake Wanaka or Lake Hawea or any of the small tributaries in terms of the freshwater going into those lakes. I think the biggest threat that I see is actually the urban space. There's not many checks and balances in place. This huge threat of urban sprawl currently happening with lots of flat land, having increased pressure on the infrastructure. So for example, the stormwater infrastructure, every time it rains, if you go down to Bremner Bay, that drain going into Bremner Bay, for example, is absolutely going for it, and there's often bits of Lego and rubbish coming into there, and you've got the tuna or the eels all swimming around that drain because there's food coming out of it, and it's an indication that there's a lot of stuff going into that lake.
After discussing the threats to our lakes and waterways, Ollie expresses gratitude towards the progressive work that farmers have done in the rural space, and we discussed how some townies like myself might be lagging in understanding and at times be pointing the finger at farms when really we can make a difference too. Here's what Ollie had to say about the transition from ignorance to ownership.
Urban space is almost lagging, so let's talk about that sort of almost ignorant space. But you can't also blame people for not knowing. And I think that's the space where I'm really trying to operate, is it's not a finger point, it's not a slap on the wrist for not understanding, it's actually acknowledging the fact it's not great and proactively and really positively trying to change that behaviour. It's not a sort of telling people off for doing it wrong, it's a, hey, we probably could do that a bit better, did you know, that type of thing, rather than, mate, you need to stop washing your car in the driveway, you're killing the tuna. Actually really trying to drive that behaviour change through community engagement and through sort of that almost sense of place and sense of ownership for the environment rather than sort of that top-down approach.
To get our conversation on the route of collaboration and cooperatives, I decided to hit Ollie with some key academia. So doing a little bit of reading on some kind of academic studies into like collective action and community-based initiatives, I came across a published paper from some researchers at the Cawthron's Institute, the University of Waikato and Victoria University of Wellington, and they had examined roles of collectives in New Zealand, and their research highlighted that community groups are essential in restoring New Zealand ecosystems, but the efforts alone are often insufficient to address large-scale biodiversity declines. I will note that none of the groups in the research were Upper Clutha based. I'm curious if these findings kind of resonate with your experiences and differences that it's made working as collectives and collaborating as opposed to these groups working individually.
Yeah, absolutely. I wholeheartedly agree with those findings that actually coming together as collectives and collaborating is the only way forward. You may have heard of the term siloing.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's really what we're trying to sort of steer away from, and it's definitely something that's very top of mind in the environmental space. There's a very limited funding pool for lots of these projects, and lots of these projects are the funding sources coming from the community or public grants and things like that. And if you have two community groups equally as passionate, equally as organised, but competing for the same funding, it's often really difficult. You might get half of it each, but that's actually not as impactful as if you came together for a collective where you might have five or six groups all buying for the same funding, but actually with the same purpose or a collective project. So it's trying to break down some of those silos and really try and come together to that more sort of collective space. And there's some really amazing collectives up in the Upper Lakes or the Upper Clutha, and it makes a humongous difference. It's potentially sometimes a lot harder to collaborate than it is just to do it by yourself, but it is the more authentic and proactive and sort of approach with a bit more longevity than just doing things individually.
Yeah, yeah. And no doubt, like, the passionate individuals behind these groups trying to make a difference, they'd rather be spending their time actually going out there to make a difference as opposed to applying for funding.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think another really big one as well is, have you heard of the term communities of practice?
I actually haven't, to be honest.
But so it's really around, there's many definitions of it, but a very loose definition is bringing those communities together. So we'll, across the board, whatever your sort of discipline is, but from an environmental perspective, it might be bringing those smaller groups into one space to maybe not necessarily form a collective voice to say collective projects or collective funding applications or anything like that, but bringing people together to share their knowledge, share their quick wins, their milestones, any lessons learnt, what's on their sort of radar for the next year, that type of stuff.
So when you've been working with these community groups and trying to get them to come together, align their goals and help them scale their restoration efforts, are there any challenges in balancing the professional management of these groups, but also making sure you maintain community engagement and making sure they still have ownership of their projects?
I think that balance between that professional management and that community ownership piece is really challenging around what you can actually allow the community to do through sort of really trying to engage and empower and sort of almost generate that ownership of, say, an environmental project, but actually what your restraints are in terms of needing to tick the right boxes, and if it's on public land, who you're engaging with, and all these sort of key stakeholders that you need to also engage is sometimes a bit challenging. But in terms of sort of the most of the community urban work that I've been a part of, it's been really, really important to bring the community along on that journey, and it's not pre-describing what the work is. So it's bringing the group together. You might only have one person who's really interested to begin with who comes to you, and then it's you're helping support and facilitate them, say, connecting with their neighbours and getting a bit of a bigger group together who might be interested in, say, forming an action group or a sort of a catchment group. In the urban space, it's sometimes a bit difficult to call them catchment groups because they might not have a traditional catchment like a stream going through. It might be that they're looking at biodiversity enhancement or trapping or stormwater, that type of thing. So it's called action groups. But you're not trying to pre-describe that work. It's not coming and going, hey, we want to do this project. It's going, hey, we've got the capacity to help you come up with your own project to make it a lot more meaningful than you pre-describing that work. And I think with that comes a lot of really genuine momentum and engagement, and really facilitates the group to build that authentic connection to the project rather than you telling them what to do. But within that space, there is also often challenges. For example, it's really important to set really clear boundaries around what they can actually do.
To jump here and provide a little more context, the groups that Ollie and I are referring to here are groups such as the Kuramoko Catchment Group, Beacon Point Restoration Group, Lakeside Road Enhancement Group, and Yo Eco. Here's Ollie quickly summarising some of the work that those groups do, as well as Ollie explaining an example of where it was really important for him to set boundaries for these groups in the urban collective.
So we now have 5 active urban action groups in the Upper Clutha, all doing really different and diverse and impactful work. But very broadly speaking, those groups are around biodiversity enhancement, freshwater quality and enhancement, pest control, so both flora and fauna, so the plants and the sort of invasive species through things like trap lines, and building that sense of place is all part of those groups as well. One of my projects, or one of my groups, was up and running. It was about a year into the project, and I kind of let them take on a bit of ownership, but there was a little bit of sort of scope creep around what was actually okay to do. And one group member took it on themselves to start pulling off all the plant guards on some quite mature beech trees, and anywhere else in the country they wouldn't need plant guards anymore. But obviously with the rabbit crisis you have in the Upper Clutha or the Upper Lakes, well, actually central as a whole, overnight those mature beech trees got totally ringbarked. So it's sort of just sort of setting some of those, giving the group the ability to take ownership, but with some really clear boundaries around what and why and why we do things, and sort of educating along the way.
Yeah, really no, for sure. That's super interesting that you've mentioned ownership a few times now, like when we were discussing the, say, resident cleaning their car and giving them understanding and ownership of their actions, but then also groups already making a positive change and making sure they can retain their ownership. But there's limits to that as well, as you've touched on.
In the next part of Ollie and I's discussion, we continue to focus on the role of engaging community groups and collectives. Using frameworks in the rural space, Ollie has successfully molded these to fit a more diverse urban community. Ollie emphasizes the importance of planning and making sure he can go from on-the-ground facilitation to a more touchpoint basis, while still retaining clear expectations, still giving groups responsibility, ownership, and actionable knowledge. Here's a couple of snippets of what Ollie had to say.
Discovered through the process, so through some of those groups maybe not going so well, and right up to where we had the six groups up and running really well, was setting those really clear expectations from the beginning around what your role was. So you didn't get into the position where you're a year down the track and the group is still heavily reliant on you.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like the kind of planning phase of that framework is just so important, and I can understand that you would have the expertise to set that up and maybe these community groups wouldn't to start with.
And I think the big thing is also getting into the importance of at the beginning, it often feels like it's going quite slowly, but it's going slow to then speed up. And if you go slow enough at the beginning and give that part of the process justice in terms of the time and resources to actually set up those really clear KPIs or really clear monitoring evaluation and set that group up for success in terms of assigning roles and bringing them on the journey, then when it does start to speed up and you start to have actions ticking off and success in the group or challenges or whatever it is, you've got really clear direction and you're not feeling like it's getting away on you because you've done the due diligence, you've done the planning, you feel like you're in control. It's going slow in the beginning to then speed up and have success further down the track.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, we've sort of discussed some ways in which, yeah, a bit of a bottom-up approach engaging the community has made a real tangible difference at the local level, especially here in Wanaka. There's an argument to be made that change needs sometimes has to come from a top-down approach, especially if you want to make change at a large scale. So like, even though small community groups can make a difference, and making this behavioural change in a bottom-up approach clearly has made a difference in Wanaka, do you think that there needs to be sort of advocacy for broader system changes, and is that something you're involved with as well?
In short, yes. Yeah, I think I totally agree that there's a space for bottom up, but there's also a really space for that top down, say policy level. Depending who you talk to, that's how you're going to get the change, right? Like some people, like you say, you can have a super engaged community, but at the end of the day, if the developer down the road is still going to put the average development in and have bottom line infrastructure off their regulations, they're not going to change what they're not going to change what they're doing unless it comes from policy. So there is those two levels and those two approaches where there's a time and place for both.
Yeah.
But I think going back to what you said in that question around community groups having all the best intentions but not necessarily having that ability to impact that policy as individuals, it really goes back to what we're talking around forming collectives.
Yeah.
So you might have individual levels doing amazing things at a local level,
and that really individual level, but actually going and forming a collective and coming together, if it's regionally or if it's even locally, but even more importantly, if it can be nationally, say a catchment collective, coming together and being a voice for 50 groups or 100 groups, that's when you can really start to leverage a community perspective and a bottom-up perspective informing that higher level.
Yeah.
So I think that's another real positive and valuable aspect of collectives is being able to inform that sort of higher top-down policy level. In short, to answer your question, yes, I think having that top-down approach is equally as important, and there's a time and place for both.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it was quite a jumble question, so thanks for clearing that up, and yeah, landed where I wanted to. Yeah, there's been so many things we could have talked about, and as you talk about like education as a piece as well, like I'd love to continue with that, but with time in mind, I'll just finish up with one final question there. So what makes you feel positive about the future in sustainability?
Great question. I think what makes me feel really positive is, leading on from the last one really, our generation is starting to sort of move into some roles that can have real impact. You see that right across the board. You look at the likes of, say, Chloe Swarbrick at that sort of national level, right down to sort of these groups like, say, YoEco or that environmental space coming into play. And it does fill you with a lot of really positive energy that it might just be that with the perspectives changing a bit as we start to get older, but I feel like there is a lot of change happening. I mean, you look at right down to the, say, climate strikes for action happening at schools.
Mm-hmm.
They were never a thing when we were kids, right? So that's fills you with a lot of sort of optimism, you could say, that this is all going to work out.
Yeah. I think it's, yeah, such a good outlook to reflect on those positive changes that have happened and, yeah, helps you look forward to future and sustainability. So, yeah, thanks for your time, Ollie. I really appreciate it. And, yeah, it was epic.
You're welcome. Anytime, mate.
I'd like to give a big thank you for Ollie for his time and knowledge, to the Masters of Sustainable Business team at Otago Uni, and to the ORC and Waiwanaka for the epic work they do. I'd also like to thank the Journal of Ecology and Society, whom published the research I mentioned in this podcast. The music used in today's episode is Way Home by Soul Production Music. Thanks, and I'll catch you next time here at the CCP.
That was really interesting, Cameron. There were a lot of things that you guys talked about in the podcast. What were your big takeaways? What's the thing that that's going to inform your practice going forward?
Yeah, I think the biggest takeaway and a bit of a theme that came up across all the different topics we talked about, those that are in the podcast and those that we talked about off microphone, I guess, was just the idea of like empowering others to make their own change, as opposed to sort of telling people what to do or saying you should do this, shouldn't do that. Oliver had a really positive emphasis on kind of giving the others opportunity to make their own positive changes in their behavior. So that was through like, he was talking about, say, his neighbor washing his car at one point and, giving, instead of kind of getting all grumpy at them, like just letting them know that, that water goes down into the lake, essentially, what it does, literally. And then also like when working with, say, community groups trying to do projects and things, like guiding them and giving them knowledge and advice, but letting them retain ownership of what they're doing so that they can feel empowered. I think that was probably the biggest takeaway.
I think there are a lot of times people don't know. I remember a couple of years ago, a friend of mine was talking about their neighbour who had a carpet cleaning business, and he had this tank that all of the, um, is it had this circulation system. So he would come into a house and he would shampoo and clean the carpet, and then everything he took out would go into a big tank. Then he would go home and empty the tank on his driveway to run down into the stormwater, and it never occurred to him where that water was going. Mm. Just didn't think about it. And yeah, do you think that sure. that's a problem? Is it that we still have this level of ignorance in the community about the basic fundamentals of where the water goes?
I think, like, I mean, yeah, for the environment, it's a problem, but I think you can't blame people for their ignorance, you know. You can only work to educate them, because, I mean, like, even I didn't know. I sort of felt that I knew some of the water from the stormwater drains around Wanaka would go there. I don't know why. I thought other places it would go somewhere else. but yeah, so I think, yeah, that's the key thing. Like, you can't blame people for their ignorance. You can only, like, educate them and give them the chance to make a difference. Yeah, I suppose in a commercial sense, like, if they're repeating and repeating and repeating these poor behaviors, once they do know, then it's another question. But yeah, I think that's them. Yeah, definitely not to finger point, but to kind of give them a nudge and say, like, hey, this is where your water's going. What do you think about that?
Mm. Is that where you're heading in your professional practice, do you think, into those kind of education and enabling spaces?
Probably not exactly. I think in some role of governance, I suppose the key component of that is educating and enabling. And yeah, it was actually talking to Oliver was quite interesting in that he works for ORC, and I guess kind of local councils and things can get a bit of a bad rap, bad reputation, and say, you know, they're just sitting on their hands or whatnot. So yeah, kind of getting to actually, like, sit down with someone who works in that space for an hour, and yeah, get insight to what they're actually doing was quite inspiring, and maybe that could be something I'll do in the future. And yeah, whether that's, like, with waterways or somewhere else, I'm looking at maybe, like, tourism at the moment. Yeah, it could potentially be something I work on in the future.
That's interesting. If I was the, like, the magic job theory, and I could wave my magic wand and put you into your perfect job, what does that look like?
Oh, great question. I think, yeah, it's actually, yeah, funny you say that after asking that other question, because I am thinking maybe that in a space where I can help, you know, small businesses who don't have the resources to contribute, like, to prioritize these things and help them take that step would be really interesting. Some sort of business development or, yeah, at the moment I'm looking, like, in my research, I guess you're going to ask about soon, but is specifically in the tourism area, because I think having worked in that, I know that there's a few things that can be improved there. So yeah, some sort of role where you're helping these small businesses develop in the right ways.
Mm, that sounds like a very good plan. So on the topic of your thesis, tell us about your thesis.
So in the planning phases at the moment of it, but I'm looking at destination management in New Zealand, and probably specifically on the practice, or still understanding it to be fair, but regenerative tourism, and how we can work towards that. And yeah, sort of looking, there's not a whole lot of research that's been done on, like, whether regional destination management organizations are actually implementing their destination management plans, because you're reading the destination management plans, you know, sometimes it seems like they're kind of throwing buzzwords out there, and potentially even worse, like, misinterpreting what is meant by things like regenerative tourism, and that can kind of dilute what, you know, like, MBIE, who's trying to push this side of tourism, is actually trying to do. So yeah, probably interviewing and working with destination management organizations to see what they've done so far and what they're planning on doing in that space, and analyzing that from the view of regenerative tourism.
I would say that Te Papa Atawhai, the Department of Conservation, would have a lot to say about that, because they, you know, we so often will see these tourism organisations will always include our conservation estate in the opportunities for people without consideration for the impact on the conservation estate.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and like, I mean, just from the few conversations I've had with kind of people working in the space at the moment, it seems there's sort of a lack of cohesion between different stakeholder groups as well, which I think is a bit of a failure in the system. You know, like, they should be, like, before they even start making the plans, you know, they should be talking and building a relationship with iwi and Department of Conservation and, you know, the locals and the community as well. But yeah, it just doesn't seem like it happens, really, eh?
No, so often it seems the motivation is bring the people in, get money from them for someone else's resources, and then go away without any care or responsibility.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, that's going to be a very valuable bit of work, I think. You won't have any trouble getting people to engage in that.
What's your...
Yeah, I hope so. Hope so.
I normally ask people what their go-to definition of sustainability is, but I'm going to ask you instead, what's your go-to definition of regenerative?
Yeah, great question. I thought you might ask that, actually. I think, like, it's... I mean, I think at its core, it's, like, leaving the environment and the community better than when you first arrived. To sort of stay, taking that step further from sustainability, where you're trying to almost potentially minimize your impact, and yeah, trying to progressively make things better than when you first got there. But yeah, as I said, like, there's quite a bit of potential confusion around that area, and even after, you know, doing a bunch of literature review, I'm still uncertain what that actually means in practice. But yeah, thankfully there's some experts in the tourism department who I'm reaching out to at the moment to find out more.
I get all of my learners, even if they're not doing a sustainability thing, to read Hess and Duplessis' Designing for Hope. It's regenerative, Designing for Hope, Regenerative Design, I think is the rest of the title.
Okay, yeah.
And the first couple of chapters of that are just, you know, if you can write a thesis about those first couple of chapters and then say, what might this mean for tourism, then you're on to a winner.
Absolutely. Because
the challenge for that book, the challenge is that the examples they use are about landscape design. And so when they're talking about things like learning from biological processes, it's kind of too easy, because it's sort of like, well, if you're designing a garden in a wetland, then what do you know? Make it a wetland.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Which is kind of obvious, but then when you start applying that to, well, in my case, to computing, what does that mean? But in your case, what does it mean if I'm if I'm somebody visiting Wanaka to go mountain biking, how can my visit make the place better?
Yeah, definitely. I think, I mean, like you said, like, the regenerative kind of concept has been in, you know, agriculture and architecture, and then now it's sort of in the last 5 years becoming a priority in tourism. And yeah, I think one of the key kind of things to link up is just thinking of your tourism practices in the sense that they're part of a bigger kind of living system around it, that sort of systems thinking. And knowing that, you know, you're not operating your tourism activities in a vacuum, and it's not just purely, you know, transactional, like, person comes in, person comes out. But yeah, like you said, like I said earlier, in terms of actually, like, practical advice you can give to tourism operators, there really isn't a lot of examples out there. So yeah, I'm looking forward to learning more about that space, and then hopefully I can go and share that knowledge with different tourism operators or at the governance level, like at regional tourism organisations, to help others implement that.
I went to a talk once by the architect for a building in Toronto the Environment Centre at the university, which is considered to have a positive impact. So things like the water leaves the building better than it enters. And so what's been really interesting for them is that they've had to change all the signs. So instead of it being the usual save water, the signs they've got up as use as much water as you like, because we're making it better. And it's an interesting thought experiment to go, okay, what would it take to have not necessarily just a sign about water, but what would it take for a sign on a mountain bike park to say your visit is making the place better?
Mm. Yeah, it's a good question.
I have some questions to end the show, and not very much time, so we're going to have to wriggle through them. What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
Oof, that is a bold question. I think coming back to study is a success in itself, even though I'm only halfway through. Being able to make that commitment to change, you know, like that is a cost in kind of making that call. You know, you give up your salary or your wages and a lot of free time, I suppose, to come back to university. So I'm pretty stoked on that front. And yeah, ran a marathon this year, which is good fun. Drop that in there. Got to work towards that one. So yeah, a couple of things there, quite different to each other.
What's your superpower?
I'm really good at Connect Four, actually. So, yeah, I challenge anyone to a game and go on pretty
confidently. You're on. You are totally on. Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
I'd say probably I wouldn't say so. Like, I'm not super outspoken publicly. Like, to people I know, like, closely, I will say if I think something can be better or I've heard something really powerful. I'm actually at the moment fiddling around with a badge that says Save Our Southern Hospital, which is ironic, I suppose. But yeah, not, I wouldn't say openly, I'm a supporter of activists, I guess. I can be a partner to them, but I'm not an activist myself.
So what motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
Just the kind of concept of being better every day. Like, I don't think you have to do a lot to kind of improve on yourself. Whether that be in a sport or at university or something else, giving things a go and incrementally getting better.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
A tricky one, because I know you've asked this question like 600 times. So I don't just want to repeat what people have said. Get outside, I suppose.
Good plan. Moira.
Yep, I like that plan. I'm going to get outside in my garden this weekend. Cameron, I've really enjoyed being in the teaching space with you. You just bring an easy laughter, and you make people feel very relaxed. And you think deeply about things, and you've got good, sound, critical thinking skills, which I always admire in people. It has been a joy to share that space with you over this year in our last paper, and I wish you all the best for the journey ahead. Thank you for the commitment that you've made to making the world better and for joining us today.
Amazing. Thank you so much. I might have to get that in writing. For my next job application.
I might have to get in and writing. You said my son's inspiring.
Yeah. Do you not? Do you think so?
Oh, I do think so. But yeah, it's nice to have other people say it. You've been listening to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. Brought to you by the Sustainable Lens team, which is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio every Wednesday afternoon at 3 and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz. You can find us on Facebook. We had a contribution today from Tahu McKenzie. I was joined today by Norwera Karatai in Whakatane, and bringing us his episode of Coming Up for Air, we've been joined by Cameron Metherall. He brought us the very fabulous Oliver Eden Man. I'm Samuel Mann. That's Blowing Bubbles. We hope you enjoyed the show. Marty Wong. So pretty as you were riding along. You look so pretty as you were singing this song. I sing the song around, round, wheels going round, round, round. Down up, pedals down, up, down. But I gotta get across to the other side of town before the sun goes. That's a bicycle built for two. I'm looking at my honey in the rearview mirror, and now I got a better view. You look so pretty as you were riding along. You look so pretty as you were singing this song. I sing the song around, round, wheels going round, round, round. Down, up, pedals, down, up, down. But I gotta get across to the other side of town before the sun.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.